If you say shit to yourself you'd never say to others, second guess yourself, and never had a healthy romantic relationship where you feel cherished and loved, I've got just the thing for you. Hi, I'm Barb Nangle, boundaries coach and three-time guest on the pod. If that's you, you have got to apply for Your Empowered Life. This is my 8-week transformational semi-private program for women so you can learn how to show up as the woman you've always wanted to be. You'll get tools to create healthy communication and relationships, feel like a sturdier woman who can say no without a flood of guilt and shame. You'll learn how to create satisfying, healthy relationships with yourself and others, and trust yourself. If you want to be authentic with yourself and others and no longer worry about what others think of you, this program is for you. Apply by March 20th at higherpowercc.com/empoweredlife or at the link in the show notes.
Shame corrodes the part of us that believes we are capable of change. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a complete and total shit show. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I am a recovering adult child. I realized this when I hit the most painful bottom of my entire life with 9 years of sobriety, when I realized, hey, alcoholism isn't really your root problem, girl. It actually turns out that you experienced trauma during your childhood. And it actually turns out that what you are experiencing in romantic relationships, when you feel like you're gonna die, when an emotionally unavailable alcoholic breaks up with you, well, that's actually something called complex PTSD. And so this is the podcast where we talk about what the hell to do about that. So welcome aboard. We curse here. You've been warned. And I am an acquired taste. So if I'm your cup of tea, you're going to really dig this shit. If not, no hard feelings. So today we are diving deep with this lovely old shit show me. Yes, we have a solo episode today, folks. And you know how I feel. You know how I get when it comes to solo episodes. I overanalyze. I overthink the shit out of these. And so let's hope that that's not the case today. And so today we are diving deep into the core wound of this adult child shit. The crux, the creme de la creme problem. Little old thing called toxic shame. Toxic shame is sort of like the golden thread that underlies everything here that we're dealing with. It weaves in and out of every aspect of this condition that we're dealing with. All of the laundry list traits are rooted in this toxic shame. These are the traits and the behaviors that we took on in response to shame becoming our identity, in response to receiving the message that our authentic self was not okay. And it's much more than that because it's really rooted in survival. We are dependent upon our parents to keep us alive. And so it's really more like, I'm not going to be taken care of. Like, I'm not going to survive unless I morph into this other version of myself, that being my authentic self is not going to keep me alive. So I need to figure out who the hell I need to be. And so for today's group, for today's shit show group, I selected a reading that was on toxic shame for the discussion. And it just really hit me, just like the heaviness of it all, how heartbreaking, how unfair it is that, you know, we were all brainwashed into believing that we are inherently flawed, that we are inherently unlovable, that who we are is not okay. You know, at a time when we didn't have the capacity, the maturity, the ability, the brain development to challenge those thoughts about ourselves. And it really is so cruel, you know? But on the flip side of that, I think it's being mindful that, you know, this is what was done to our parents. I mean, I'm sure some of y'all disagree, but for me personally, like, I don't think that my parents intentionally set out to raise me to believe that, you know, I'm inherently flawed and unlovable. As I've said, this is the disease of family dysfunction. This shit doesn't just pop out of nowhere. It's passed from generation to generation. Now, does that mean that I'm giving my parents a free pass? No. However, I think it depersonalizes it somewhat, you know, to understand just the insidious nature of all of this. So we are going to dive into this lovely old topic today and really dissect how shame becomes our identity, looking at the circumstances that led to shame becoming my identity, this internalization process, and what the hell to do about that. So let's just get the damn show on the road. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. This is where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are also trying to heal from this core wound. Community, connection, relationship is so fucking important as far as, you know, breaking through this shame. It is really something that we can't overcome on our own. We need other people that understand what it is that we're going through. So let's just do the damn thing, folks. This community is a shame busta. Okay, so hop on the shame busta train known as the shit show. Let's do the damn thing. See the link in the show notes for the way for you to join. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. This is a requirement, folks, and I would really, really, really appreciate it if you're on Apple. If you could just write a few words, folks, you could even just say like cool or groovy. Having the written reviews, it helps Apple to, you know, suggest this podcast to more users, more listeners. So don't you want to help other people find this damn podcast? I know you do. Thank you. Love you all. Man, it's a shame the way you hurt me. It's a shame the way you mess around with me. All right, y'all. Let's get into this lovely, light, fluffy, warm topic of toxic shame. But before we dive into toxic shame, let's first talk about plain shame, normal shame, which is a normal human emotion that arises when we have the awareness that we've done something either, you know, dishonorable or improper. And while no one wants to feel shame, shame feels like shit, okay? It is unfortunately a fundamental part of the human experience. And it's actually healthy to experience, as all emotions are healthy to experience. But why is shame healthy? Well, one, it lets us know that we're not sociopaths, because sociopaths typically don't experience shame. But more importantly, shame often serves as the catalyst to positive change in our lives. You know, shame is the red flag to self that we have acted out of alignment in a moral sense, that we have acted in a way that is not aligned with our integrity. It reminds us of our essential limitations as humans, that we're not perfect, that we're going to make mistakes, and thus it presents us with opportunities to grow and become better versions of ourselves. However, this ain't the case with toxic shame. You know, toxic shame is internalized shame. And so when an emotion is internalized, and we're going to talk about this internalization process, it no longer functions as an emotion and becomes one's identity. So when one internalizes shame, they no longer feel shame. It is no longer an emotion for that person. It becomes a state of being, a core identity. And this is the core identity of the adult child. You know, regardless of our childhood experiences, they may vary. What lies underneath for all of us, what we all have in common, yay us, is this like all pervasive, unconscious sense that we are inherently flawed, that we are unlovable, that we are unworthy of connection. And I think the biggest thing to note here is that it is unconscious. Like most of us have no damn clue that that's how we feel about ourselves until we realize that's how we feel about ourselves. At least, you know, that was the case for me. As I've shared many times before, On a conscious level, I thought I had high self-esteem, high self-worth, but my actions clearly showed otherwise. My actions clearly showed that I thought very little of myself, but I wasn't going to be able to see that until I was ready to see that. And I was recently actually having a conversation with somebody trying to explain to them that they suffer from toxic shame. And that it wasn't going through, folks. It's like trying to get through to an alcoholic if they're an alcoholic before they're ready to see it. Somebody who's not ready to see that they have toxic shame, it doesn't matter how we say it, it's not going to get through. So healing the shame that binds us, that is the Bible on toxic shame. It is also an adult child must read. It is by John Bradshaw. And within the book, he discusses this internalization process, this three-step process of how shame becomes one's identity. So he says, any human emotion can become internalized. When internalized, an emotion stops functioning as emotion and becomes an identity. I already said that. Internalization involves at least three processes. Number one, identification with unreliable and shame-based models, which is the source of our carried shame. Two, the trauma of abandonment, which severs the interpersonal bridge and the bindings of feelings, needs, and drives with shame. And three, the interconnection of memory imprints, which forms collages of shame. So let's break down these three processes. I'm going to read some stuff verbatim too, because you just need to hear it straight from John Bradshaw's mouth. So first is this thing called identification. So he says, identification is one of the normal human processes. We always have the need to identify. Identification gives a sense of security. By belonging to something larger than ourselves, we feel the security and protection of the larger reality. The need to identify with someone, to feel a part of something and belong somewhere, is one of our most basic needs. He says, when children have shame-based parents, they identify with them. This is the first step in the child's internalizing shame because the children carry their parents' shame. So the second process is the trauma of abandonment. So he says, shame is internalized when one is abandoned. Abandonment is the precise term to describe how one loses one's authentic self and ceases to exist psychologically. Children cannot know who they are without reflective mirrors. Mirroring is done by one's primary caregivers and is crucial in the first years of your life. Abandonment includes the loss of mirroring. Parents who are shut down emotionally, as all shame-based parents are, cannot mirror and affirm their children's emotions. Since the earliest period of our life was pre-verbal, everything depended on emotional interaction. Without someone to reflect our emotions, we had no way of knowing who we were. Mirroring remains important during our entire life. Besides lack of mirroring, abandonment includes neglect of developmental dependency needs, abuse of any kind, and enmeshment into the covert or overt needs of the parents or the family system. Abandonment induces shame in the child who is utterly dependent on the parents. And then it says, the shame binding of feelings, needs, and natural instinctual drives is the key factor in changing healthy shame into toxic shame. To be shame-bound means that whenever you feel any feeling, need, or drive, you immediately feel ashamed. The dynamic core of your human life is grounded in your feelings, needs, and drives. When these are bound by shame, you are shamed to the core. Cool. Woohoo. Sounds good. Okay, and this third part, which I think really puts a nail in the coffin. So the interconnection of memory imprints that form collages of shame. As shaming experiences accrue and are defended against, the images created by those experiences are recorded in a person's memory bank. Because the victim has no time or support to grieve the pain of the broken mutuality, his emotions are repressed and the grief is unresolved. The verbal imprints remain in the memory, as do the visual images of the shaming scenes. As each new shaming experience takes place, a new verbal imprint and visual image form a scene that becomes attached to the existing ones to form collages of shaming memories. Children record their parents' actions at their worst. When mom and dad or step-parent or caregiver are most out of control, they're the most threatening to their child's survival. The child's amygdala, their survival alarm center in the brain, registers these behaviors the most deeply. Any subsequent shame experiences that even vaguely resemble that past trauma can easily trigger the words and scenes of the original trauma. What are then recorded are the new experiences and the old. Over time, an accumulation of shame scenes is attached. Each new scene potentiates, you know what I'm trying to say, potentiates the old, sort of like a snowball rolling down a hill, getting larger and larger as it picks up snow. As the years go on, very little is needed to trigger these collages of shame memories. A word, a similar facial expression, or a scene can set it off. Sometimes an external stimulus is not even necessary. Just going back to an old memory can trigger an enormously painful experience. Shame as an emotion has become frozen and embedded into the core of the person's identity. Shame is deeply internalized. And this really goes to show why, for me, each breakup was just more painful than the last, right? It's because I had this fucking shame snowball that just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So now I want to talk about what this internalization process looked like for me. Many of y'all are familiar with this, the story of my story, but please just bear with me. I was actually going to play clips from my second and third episode where I really go through this, but I just decided I just retell the story. It was actually really interesting listening to those episodes because they were recorded 3 years ago. So on March 31st, that will be 3 years since I released my first episode, which is absolutely crazy. But let's talk about my internalization process, which really is largely built around me being deemed the scapegoat of my family. So as I've shared before, you know, I found out my mom was an alcoholic when I was 7. We were out to dinner one night. It was me and my mom. We were waiting for my dad to get there. I remember my mom had ordered a beer. She was barely drinking it. I could tell that she was upset. When my dad got there, she started to cry at a certain point. My mom took me to the bathroom and I asked her what was wrong. And she said, I'm an alcoholic. And being that I was 7, I had no damn clue what that meant. So I said, what does that mean? And she said, it means that I can't drink anymore. And what I like to say, it was like I went to bed that night and I woke up the next morning having skipped several stages of development. And I also seemed to have developed this sixth sense as it related to my mom's drinking. You know, I could feel it in my bones hours before she would even pick up a drink. And the times that she drank the most was when my dad was out of town. My dad traveled a lot for work. And so she was always there to pick me up from school, to pick me up from swim practice, to feed me, to put me to bed, but she would be drunk. And my dad was very aware that this was what was going on. And when he was in town, I was a sidekick. I was his emotional confidant. I was his like Watson in a way, like he was Sherlock and I was Watson. And we would search the house, like looking for her booze. We would go into the liquor cabinet and use a paint stick to measure and monitor each like level of the bottles. Like why the fuck were the bottles? Why did we even have liquor in the house anyway? And yeah, like my mom's drinking was a secret from the rest of the world. So he just used me to talk about it. And so one day, I was 9 years old. I woke up in the middle of the night and I felt like I was going to die unless I slept in my mom's bed. And I went into my parents' room. My dad was in town and they did what they've done in the past when I'd woke up with a bad dream or, you know, occasionally I would wake up upset in the middle of the night and they would go in there and they'd walk me back and I could fall back asleep. But this night was different for some reason and I was relentless and I felt like I was going to fucking die if I couldn't sleep in my mom's bed. And so it was just this back and forth and this back and forth. And eventually when they realized that no one was going to get any sleep, my dad threw in the towel, he let me sleep in my mom's bed and he went and slept in my bed. And this started a pattern of me every night sleeping in my mom's bed. So I'd fall asleep in my bed, but in the middle of the night, I would go and I would switch places with my dad. Now, up until this point, I already had separation anxiety issues. I was already the girl that couldn't go to the sleepovers. I was the one that, you know, as soon as I got close to bedtime, I was the girl that got sick and had to go home. So after several months of this me sleeping in my mom's bed and my dad sleeping in my bed, my parents sent me to see a child psychologist. And it was in that moment that I became, you know, the scapegoat, the identified patient of my family. No, not because they sent me to see a therapist. Clearly, there were issues that needed to be addressed. The crime, the failure was what they failed to disclose to the therapist. I think in my second episode, I say like once I got sober, but I think this was more around like 15 or 16, I asked my mom, did you tell that therapist that you were an alcoholic and that you and dad fought all the time? And her response to me was, no, it didn't seem relevant. And so that's what I mean by being deemed the scapegoat and the identified patient. The don't talk rule that applied to my mother's alcoholism and the other things that was going on in the family didn't apply to me and my problems. However, I had already learned that when one morning when I walked into my fourth grade class and one of my friends said loud enough for the entire class to hear, CJ told us that you sleep in bed with your mom every night. My dad had played tennis with CJ's dad that weekend. So you see, my separation anxiety was the problem, as opposed to my separation anxiety being a cry for help of me sounding the alarm bells for what was actually going on in the home. And so let's just spend a little bit of time talking about scapegoating, as it is a very common experience amongst us. Where are my scapegoats at? So scapegoating is a common diversion tactic and defense mechanism among dysfunctional families by placing all attention and energy on the scapegoat. Family members then avoid confronting their own problems, their own shortcomings, their own marital difficulties, and it is one of the most insidious forms of psycho-emotional abuse. And it is typically unconscious. So Rebecca Mandeville, who is the queen of the scapegoats, she is the person responsible for coining the term scapegoat abuse. So I've had her on the podcast and I will include a link to that episode in the show notes. She is responsible for coining the term family scapegoat abuse. And she describes it as the most insidious form of psycho-emotional abuse that a child can endure, because not only are most adult survivors unaware of the negative and pervasive impact that this has on them for the rest of their lives, but most are completely oblivious to the reality of having suffered any abuse at all. And so she discusses how there's two ways, generally speaking, that scapegoats are selected, the unconscious way and the conscious way. So the unconscious way is in alignment with the family projection process as conceptualized by family systems theorist Murray Bowen. And here's how it works. Every family has its own set of anxieties and tensions. These could be related to communication problems, unresolved conflict, or unmet emotional needs. In order to alleviate this anxiety, the family unconsciously identifies one member to carry the burden of these unresolved issues, this person becomes the scapegoat. The scapegoat is then blamed for various problems within the family, regardless of whether they're actually responsible or not. They become the target onto which the family's frustrations and tensions are projected. Scapegoating serves as a function within the family system. And so by focusing the negative attention on one individual, it temporarily relieves the underlying tension among the other family members. So it is a way for the family to avoid dealing with its deeper issues, i.e. my mother's alcoholism and my parents' marital difficulties and my father's work addiction and emotional unavailability. So that would be the unconscious way that scapegoating happens. But then there is the more conscious version, and that would be within a narcissistic family system. And this is typically where the narcissistic parent will more deliberately select a golden child and a scapegoat. And the rest of the family who is submissive to the narcissist, therefore goes along with the process and abides by treating this individual as the identified problem of the family. So by the time I got to middle school, I was sleeping in my own bed again, and I could successfully attend a sleepover. But the alcoholism, the neglect, the parentification continued within my family. And I also began to act out in other ways that fulfilled my parents' projection of me. This faulty belief that there was something inherently wrong with me had begun this internalization process and took me as its hostage and was really cemented in the seventh grade. So it is a Friday night during Christmas break of seventh grade. And me and my friend, I called her Sally. This is the story I tell in my third episode. We get invited to a high school party. So to provide a little bit of context about who I was at this point, you know, I wouldn't say that Sally and I were the bad girls, but we were the more mature girls in our grade. We were the first to get our periods, the first to kiss a boy, the first to get drunk, the first to smoke cigarettes, the girls who were scantily dressed at dances. I shared the story about how our parents would drop us off at these dances. We used to go to these, they were called the DJ Howard Mixers, and they were at the Villanova skating rink, and they were dances where a bunch of different schools were allowed to come to, and God, I just lived for them. But so our parents would drop us off. We'd be wearing, you know, polos and jeans, and as soon as we'd get inside, we'd strip down to the clothes we had underneath, which were clothes that we typically bought from a store at the King of Prussia Mall called Bang Bang. So it's this Friday night and we get invited to this party. So we're sleeping over at Sally's house because we knew we could sneak out of her house. We had done it before. So as soon as we saw the lights go off in her parents' house, we're out the dining room window with a plastic bag in tow with Smirnoff ice bottles that I had stolen from the house that I had babysat earlier that evening. Yes, I was a really great babysitter. And so the party was at a house that was about a 15-minute walk away. It was at this girl's house who actually, she lived in the clergy house at this Methodist church. So her dad wasn't the pastor there. They were just renting the house. So as fate would have it, as we arrive at the party, we found out that the party had already been busted by the cops and that the only people left were the girl whose house it was and five ninth graders that were from our school. And these were not just any boys. Like, these were the boys that we had been obsessed with since the beginning of middle school. So these were the popular eighth grade boys when we were in the sixth grade. And we, you know, each had our designated guy, and we each had granted them a nickname. I don't remember all the nicknames. I remember the one that I liked. He was rather pale. His nickname was Ghost. But what I do remember is that these guys found out that we had nicknames for them. And so they decided to return the favor with mine being Awkwardly Tall Girl. Just what every girl in middle school wants to be called, right? Awkwardly Tall Girl. I'm totally okay with it now. Okay, so back to the party. And the moral of the story is that me and Sally ended up giving oral sex to two of the ninth grade boys. I do just want to say that, you know, we weren't like pressured into doing this. This was definitely very much a choice on our part. Why? Or I could at least speak for myself. I thought that it would make me cool. But the exact opposite thing happened when we got back to school in January. The entire school knew what had happened. So this was a very prestigious private school outside of Philadelphia that went from kindergarten to 12th grade. So when I say everyone, I mean everyone in middle school, everyone in high school, all of their parents, all of the teachers, and nobody thought that we were cool. They all thought that we were sluts, and we were harassed on a daily basis. And that was my life for the rest of the school year. And I actually had it a lot worse than my friend, because my friend had a brother in the 10th grade, and he eventually stepped into the bullying and the harassment on her behalf, and people laid off her, but not me. I didn't have any siblings, and I became the girl that no one wanted to be friends with. I became the girl that no one was allowed to be friends with. Now, mind you, I had already lost my other best friend at the beginning of the school year after my mom caught us drinking together. And that's really when that internalization of shame process was complete. That was when shame became my identity. That was when I no longer felt shame. I believed that I was shame. And it was this belief that I was unworthy of connection that was deeply, deeply ingrained in me subconsciously. So back to healing the shame that binds us. And I've brought this up on the podcast before, that when shame is internalized in that moment, that is when our true self goes into hiding and the false self is created. And he explains how this false self can go one of two ways. The first is shameful acting out or an attempt to be less than human. So this is when the child leans into this belief that they are inherently flawed and they act accordingly. And the other option is this shameless acting in, which is an attempt to be more than human when the child tries to be perfect in order to cover up their feelings of being flawed. So I took the less than human route, the shameful acting out route. I started smoking pot. I started sneaking out of the house at night. Eventually, my parents found out and they put a security system on the house to keep me in, not to keep other people out. I had my first blackout, which would become a regular occurrence for me. I lost my virginity. I let half my class feel me up in the back of a coach bus on a class trip to Gettysburg. Honestly, that is like one of the most shameful memories I have still, is being on that bus. It just creates this visceral reaction within me. My grades plummeted. I was suspended once for forging a note. I got a Saturday detention for stealing a bowl of tortellini from the cafeteria. And then at the end of the school year, I was informed that it would be best for me if I did not return the following year. And so I started the next year, eighth grade in public school. That would be the year that I got sent to rehab. And I really didn't have any genuine connection with other people until I got sober. But again, I want to reemphasize how this toxic shame is so pervasive and unconscious. You know, just as I was oblivious to the true impact my childhood had on me. The same goes for this situation. I did not realize the long-term ramifications this experience would have on me. And now what I know is that toxic shame permeated my core for the next 15 years. And I carried this experience and I carried this belief that I was unworthy of connection into various situations and various relationships. And I would essentially just manifest it into my reality. It would just reaffirm this belief and intensify this toxic shame within. And this is this shame snowball that I discussed earlier. You know, this initial shaming incident is relived internally over and over, causing our sense of shame to deepen and to keep us stuck in destructive thought and behavior patterns. You know, I would spend the subsequent years in and out of boarding schools and rehabs. I would eventually get sober. And I thought that I dealt with my shit, right? I thought that alcohol was my problem, as I mentioned in the introduction of the episode. You know, I would later find out that it wasn't, that really the core issue was my childhood, was this complex trauma, this toxic shame that was permeated from my core that still showed up in various ways. And boy, is this shit heavy, folks. And so now we're going to get into the what the hell do we do about it. I'm not going to talk too long on this part just because this is what we talk about in every episode, right? Like the what the hell do we do about it? And it's complex and takes a long time. I do just want to say I've made great strides, right? Like I have done a whole hell of a lot of healing and I am such a different person than I was when I hit my adult child bottom in 2018. And I am such a different person than I am just 3 years ago when I started this podcast. But folks, like there's always more work to be done. You know, it's like fortunately and unfortunately, there's always more work to be done. And I just continue to be blown away just at how impactful and pervasive and insidious all of this is and the ways in which toxic shame still shows up in certain areas of my life. The difference is that I am so aware of what's going on. And there's more parts of me now that have healed that shame than are unhealed. And I know that. And it gives me hope for those parts that still need to be healed. But boy, is this a lot of work. And boy, does this take a lot of time, you know? So, let's just briefly touch upon the externalization process that John Bradshaw mentions in Healing the Shame That Binds You. So he says, to heal our toxic shame, we must come out of hiding. As long as our shame is hidden, there is nothing we can do about it. In order to change our toxic shame, we must embrace it. There is an old therapeutic adage that states the only way out is through. Embracing our shame involves pain. Pain is what we try to avoid. In fact, most of our neurotic behavior is due to the avoidance of legitimate pain. We try to find an easier way. This is perfectly reasonable. In the case of shame, the more we avoid it, the worse it gets. Well, fuck you, John Bradshaw. We cannot change our internalized shame until we externalize it. Doing the shame reduction work is simple but difficult. It mainly involves what I call methods of externalization. Externalization methods include 1, coming out of hiding by social contact, which means honestly sharing our feelings with significant others. 2, seeing ourselves mirrored and echoed in the eyes of at least one non-shaming person. 3, working a 12-step program. 4, doing shame reduction work by legitimizing our abandonment trauma, We do this by writing and talking about it. Writing especially helps to externalize past shame and experiences. We can then externalize our feelings about the abandonment. We can express them, grieve them, clarify them, and connect with them. 5, externalizing our lost inner child. We do this by making conscious contact with the vulnerable child part of ourselves. 6, learning to recognize various split-off parts of ourselves. As we make these parts conscious, we embrace and integrate them. 7, making new decisions to accept all parts of ourselves with unconditional positive regard. Learning to say, I love myself for ... Learning to externalize our needs and wants by becoming more self-assertive. 8, externalizing unconscious memories from the past, which form collages of shame scenes, and learning how to heal them. 9, externalizing the voices in our heads. These voices keep our shame spirals in operation. Doing exercises to stop our shaming voices and learning to replace them with new, nurturing, and positive voices. 10, learning to be aware of certain interpersonal situations most likely to trigger shame spirals. 11, learning how to deal with critical and shaming people by practicing assertive techniques and creating an externalization shame anchor. He goes more into the shame anchor in the book. 12, learning how to handle our mistakes and having the courage to be imperfect. And 13, finally, learning through prayer and meditation to create an inner place of silence wherein we are centered and grounded in a personally valued higher power. And 14, discovering our life's purpose and spiritual destiny. So that was 14 damn steps there, folks. And that'll take you a lifetime. That'll take you a lifetime. But the last thing I just want to comment on when he talks about this externalization process, he talks about there being first the first order change. So he says, what that means is that I changed one kind of behavior for another kind of behavior within a given way of behaving. I quit drinking and isolating. I shared my experiences, strength, and hope. I started talking and sharing my feelings. I started feeling my feelings again. My shame was reduced, but still active. This was evidenced by the fact that I was still compulsive and having trouble with intimacy. I chose women who I felt needed me, confusing love with pity. I set up rescuing type relationships in which others became dependent on me and saw me as all powerful. I started working 12-hour days, including Saturdays. I smoked more and started eating lots of sugar. Indeed, I had stopped a life-threatening disease called alcoholism. I had reduced my shame. I felt better about myself, but I was still compulsive and driven. I was not yet free. And I can really, really relate to that. And that's exactly where I was when I hit my adult child bottom with 9 years of sobriety, with 9 years of AA, of 12-step work. I had definitely improved. I was no longer suffering from alcoholism, but I was not yet free. And so then he talks about this second order change. And he says, in order to reduce the core of my shame and stop being compulsive, I needed a second order change. I needed to grieve the pain of my abandonment. This is the pathway to second order change. It involves going back and resolving the unresolved issues in my family of origin. In order to get free, I had to do my family of origin work. I still needed to grow up and truly leave home. And so how do we do that? I mean, I just read that all those damn steps is all the way that we do that. And there's so many modalities and ways that we do that. There's inner child work, there's somatic work, there's EMDR, there's internal family systems. There are so many ways, but I hope what you can take away from this episode is that, you know, you're not alone. You're not alone. We are all in it, in this toxic shame game. You are not shame. You are not inherently flawed. You are not unlovable. And I'm so sorry that, you were made to believe that, you know, that sucks. It really sucks for all of us. And I'm just so grateful we have this opportunity to do something about it, because so many people are going to spend their entire lives crippled, imprisoned by this toxic shame and never realize that that's what's going on for them. And we need to consider ourselves really fucking lucky that we are one of those people that not only has the awareness, but that we have the willingness to do this hard, deep work. And again, just going to give a little plug for the shit show. You can't do this shit alone, folks. Damn the Join shit show. It is a shame. Bust a group. I love you all, and I will talk to you soon.